Looking for inspiring stories? Listen to the EY Leading Into Tomorrow podcast. It features compelling stories from leaders across government and the public sector who've transformed their organizations and services. From the impact of grants to how digital innovation is reshaping affordable childcare, you'll get actionable insights and ideas that can be used around the world. Download Leading Into Tomorrow by EY wherever you get your podcasts.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
It used to be known as the Paris of the Middle East. Beirut was always a hub for cosmopolitan glamour.
This is Lebanon, and below us is the capital city of the country, a magical sounding name, Beirut. And the stores are full of the latest merchandise from New York, London, Paris, and Rome. And in common with all big cities, when night falls, electric signs blaze out, offering dancing until the dawn.
But now, Lebanon is on the verge of collapse.
No health, no food, no gas, no electricity, no hope.
The situation is very bad in Lebanon because there is no electricity, no water.
We paid like four times the amount of the usual tank of gas. It's crazy. It's been affecting my mental health. So the best decision for me now is to take the first opportunity to leave the country.
While the rest of the world was looking the other way, preoccupied by a global pandemic, Lebanon has been brought to its knees by one of the worst financial crises the world has ever seen.
There was a joke that no one took COVID very seriously here because even at its worst, it was only the fourth biggest thing anyone had to worry about.
You're listening to Stories of Our Times from The Times and The Sunday Times. I'm Manveen Rana. Today, Lebanon, anatomy of a failed state.
I've been living in the Middle East for 12 years now, but in Beirut in Lebanon, I've been based since I joined The Times 5 years ago.
That's The Times Middle East correspondent, Richard Spencer. As a resident of Beirut, his world was turned upside down last year as a blast ripped through the city. It was a watershed moment for the country.
A year last August, there was this catastrophic explosion.
Just after 6 p.m. local time on Tuesday, the 4th of August, an explosion ripped through Beirut's port.
There has been a huge explosion in the Lebanese capital, Beirut. The blast rocked the whole city.
Country already deep in crisis has been hit by a catastrophe.
At the port of Beirut, which is just down the hill from where I live, less than half a mile from the port, the damage was quite extraordinary. I was quite lucky. I was blown across my flat, but managed to sort of land in one piece amid a sort of pile of debris. All my shutters were blown in and the windows were blown out. And other people obviously suffered even worse. 200 people died from extraordinary cross-section of Lebanese society, as we discovered as the days went on.
The Beirut blast, which became one of the biggest and most powerful non-nuclear explosions the world has ever seen, wasn't the result of war or a foreign attack. It was a symptom of a corrupt and failing administration. When the blast struck, Lebanon was already a country on the brink.
Apart from the physical damage, there was a huge emotional damage because Lebanon has been going through this extraordinary financial crisis, which has wiped out everyone's savings. Many people's bank accounts have been frozen because of a freeze in the banking system. The currency has collapsed, inflation is going through the roof, and the explosion for many people was just the final straw. And since then, I think it's estimated that 300,000 people have left the country to look for work elsewhere. I mean, this is a small country of 4.5 million Lebanese with another million Syrians on top. So the damage and the emotional damage and the physical and financial damage of the explosion has proved just as bad as everyone feared.
I mean, paint a picture for us, you know, from your own experience of day-to-day life, just how bad are things in Lebanon at the moment?
It's now got the worst inflation of any country in the world. People are spending their entire minimum wage on filling up their car with petrol, you know. That's the state we're in. What's happened this year is that though that financial crisis has given way to the inevitable consequences of that in everybody's daily life. So people have lost their jobs, people can't afford basic foodstuffs anymore because people's effective salary has lost 9/10 of its value in terms of what it can buy.
Every day is worse than the day before. I was told my apartment was gone after I lost my job. I couldn't find a new job. Money is still stuck in the bank. So everything is pushing us out.
And the final blow was the collapse of the electricity grid.
Lebanon has seen some dark days, but these may be its longest nights. A country that has been brought to its knees by political crisis can now no longer keep the lights on.
The country could no longer afford to import fuel for the power stations. And so we now get 2 hours of power a day. All through the summer, people were reliant on private generators to run air conditioners and fridges and so on. But then they ran out of fuel as well, or they had to pay a massive premium to buy diesel for the generators on the black market. So at the height of the summer, even for someone like me, you know, I have dollars. I'm paid in Western currency, so I'm super rich now by local standards, but actually it doesn't mean anything if you can't get electricity. I have a private generator, but with the shortages and everything, I was getting 6 hours power a day from my apartment block's generator, then, you know, maybe an hour a day from the national grid. You had to choose, you know, do I have an air conditioner, or do you heat your water for a bath, or do you have your fridge on? You know, even for me, I was making those choices. You have to make these incredibly tough choices all the time about how you spend what little money you have left. You know, if you think that someone earning what would have been a very respectable local wage as a teacher of, you know, $20,000 or $30,000 a year, now effectively earning $2,000 a year, and suddenly you're paying hundreds. My generator bill this month worked out as £250, let's say, for, you know, 8 to 10 hours electricity a day. So, you know, you're paying
for one month.
And you're, so if you're on a middle class wage, you're paying, you know, maybe half to a quarter of your income on electricity. And that's for the, you know, the middle and upper middle classes. If you're working class and your salary has gone down from $500 a month to $50 a month in practice, which is a lot of people, a lot of people that applies to, then you can't afford a generator. And so you get your 2 hours of electricity a day from the grid.
I know you've been talking to lots of people in Beirut. You know, how have their lives changed for people who aren't being paid in dollars? What does life look like now?
So, I mean, I can tell you from the experience of friends and people I've interviewed, it's not too crude to say that there's a big class divide. I mean, there's always a class divide in any society, of course, but I mean, for both classes of people, there's a huge, huge shock and an absolutely devastating blow to your lifestyle. In some ways, the humiliation is worse if you're well off because, you know, you're in a position you never expected to be in. You know, you never expected to be begging money off relatives who live abroad. A friend was telling me the other day, never thought that their lifestyle would be ever jeopardized, I think. She suddenly realizes she's dependent on her son who lives in California and has a tech job in Silicon Valley, now pays her rent. I mean, that's, you know, that's what it takes.
If the people of Lebanon are struggling with soaring prices and a lack of electricity, the same problems are rapidly dismantling the infrastructure. Hospitals, in particular, have been hit hard. As they struggle to keep the lights on, the cost of even the most basic medicines has suddenly become unaffordable.
Last week, A woman came, she was pregnant, she had preeclampsia, which is hypertension in pregnancy, and she lost her baby because we don't have magnesium. Had magnesium cost like 2-3 cents.
So I was in Tripoli last month talking to hospitals there and some of these extraordinary problems. I was talking to a hospital director who, you know, you might expect a hospital director to be overseeing prioritization of care programs and, you know, the development of new treatments and so on. But actually what he was doing was going around trying to source diesel on the black market to, you know, fuel the hospital generators. Obviously, you can't rely on the grid. In Lebanon, hospitals rely almost entirely on generators. So this guy was trying to get black market diesel to keep the generators going, to keep the ventilators and life support systems on. I mean, incredible if you think about it.
With the economy in free fall, there's a rush for the exit, with hundreds of thousands of Lebanese citizens leaving the country, causing a chronic brain drain.
I talked to nursing staff and I talked to the head of nursing at one hospital run by a Muslim charitable foundation, you know, very nice middle-aged woman called Fatima. And she was just talking about how her colleagues were leaving and how difficult it was to keep staff when, as I say, salaries had collapsed in real value. And Lebanese people are incredibly well qualified to live abroad because of the historic multiculturalism here. You know, if they're educated here, you know, people are being taught in French, English and Arabic together. So many of the professional classes are trilingual and can operate in an Arab society or a Western society pretty easily. And she said she'd lost a third of her nurses at her hospital had left since the start of the financial crisis. So that was about 70 out of 200. Imagine trying to keep a hospital going when that's happening. I asked her about herself and whether she'd thought about leaving, and she started to cry. I mean, I was completely taken aback. And she said, but I always promised that I would stay in Lebanon and stay at Tripoli and serve my community, and that's what I've done. But I look at my children every day and think, how can I do this to you? She knows now, as many people have decided, that they could get a better life, not just for them, but for their children. Who would ever imagine that what had been an incredibly prosperous society on the face of it, that they would be having to get by on $50 a month? And that's where you see these, you know, extraordinary figures, like a third of all nurses have left the country, apparently, in the last year and a half. Imagine what that does to the infrastructure of a country.
How did Lebanon go from being a successful, stable part of the Middle East to a country in collapse? We find out what went wrong. But first,
I'm Matt Chorley. I'm a columnist for The Times and presenter on Times Radio. And we try to cover all the biggest stories and bringing you politics without the boring bits. We can only do this thanks to subscribers of The Times and The Sunday Times. So subscribe today by visiting thetimes.co.uk/stories of our times.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Looking for inspiring stories? Listen to the EY Leading Into Tomorrow podcast. It features compelling stories from leaders across government and the public sector who've transformed their organizations and services. From the impact of grants to how digital innovation is reshaping affordable childcare, you'll get actionable insights and ideas that can be used around the world. Download Leading Into Tomorrow by EY wherever you get your podcasts.
Lebanon is in the midst of an extraordinary economic meltdown. Inflation is rising so fast, it's being compared to the worst days of the Weimar Republic. When the World Bank declared that Lebanon was experiencing one of the world's worst financial crises since the 1800s, a former Lebanese finance minister thought they were understating the case.
What's happening today in Lebanon, I call mafia economics. These politicians and policymakers are holding Lebanon and the Lebanese hostage. This is the biggest financial crash in history.
So how did we get here? To understand how this crisis first began, we really need to go back to the 1990s, as after 15 years of civil war, Lebanon began to wrestle with peace.
This was once the richest part of the richest city in the Middle East. Now it's the front line of the war in the Lebanon. The war has lasted 12 months. It has ruined a country and destroyed a nation.
Lebanon began to rebuild from the rubble of war. But as the shiny skyscrapers and swanky shopping districts shot up, so did Lebanon's growing mountain of debt.
What it was able to do was it had the skills and the international contacts and the ability to raise funds from abroad to reinvest in Lebanon. I mean, really going back, I mean, I remember a friend going off to write a guidebook to Beirut in the early 90s because it was the new happening place. You know, for a few years, you know, Beirut was being rebuilt. And it was being rebuilt partly by, for example, Saudi money. So the Sunni Muslim faction, which ended up sort of dominant to some extent after the civil war, was close to Saudi Arabia. The dominant politician, Sunni Muslim politician, was a guy called Rafik Hariri, who owned a building firm in Saudi Arabia. So it was pretty easy for him to go to Saudi, get loads of investment, and he awarded himself the contract to rebuild central Beirut, which is kind of what he did. And, you know, the other factions did the same. And so you saw this massive rebuilding of Lebanon and the rebuilding of the hospitals, of the, you know, the banking system. And this was all very well and good. But the problem was, of course, it tied economic development to this elite class. And, of course, that became very corrupt. They took a lot of the money, which was not kind of shared out equally, obviously.
So although the centre of Beirut had been lavishly rebuilt, the money coming in was mainly benefiting the elite. I used to live in the city 7 years ago when I was covering the Middle East for the BBC. Back then, we didn't know the economy would collapse, but there were signs of trouble. That part of downtown Beirut was now full of expensive designer stores and glossy bars and restaurants, but it was like a ghost town. Locals in Beirut couldn't afford to shop or hang out there. And the tourists, the rich Saudis and the Europeans who used to bring money into the economy, had stopped coming because of the war next door in Syria. It was hard to see where the money was coming from to keep these shops open.
It was really a slow burn after the worldwide financial crisis. You know, gradually the amount of money that was flowing around the world started to decline, and countries became much more dependent on debt. You know, national debts grew massively. And Lebanon sort of engaged in what can only be described as economic wishful thinking. They, instead of saying, right, we have to take a hit, we're not going to get all this investment from around the world anymore, we have to start increasing productivity ourselves, building factories, starting to export goods, they engaged in a sort of economic fix based around the exchange rate, which kept the money coming in by establishing a sort of an unrealistically favorable fixed exchange rate. And that worked for a while. But then as the dollar started to run out, they basically set up a Ponzi scheme.
You may have heard of Ponzi schemes. They're basically financial swindles where people are encouraged to invest by exceptionally high rates of return. But the swindlers are just taking money off new clients in order to pay off old clients. There's no real investment that these profits are being based on. So as soon as new clients stop investing, the whole thing comes crashing down. It's not often that you can apply that concept to an entire country. How did Lebanon pull off a nation-sized financial scam? Well, here's how it worked. After the financial crisis in 2008, interest rates all over the world fell to almost zero, except in Lebanon. Banks in the country pushed interest rates up to really high levels, so the Lebanese diaspora all over the world would be tempted to deposit their savings in Lebanese banks. And all the new dollars which were now coming into Lebanon were being pumped into the central bank, which used them to prop up government spending, with no real plan of how they'd pay it all back. The whole system was bound to come crashing down, which it did, catastrophically.
Over two decades, money flowed from citizens to enriched bankers. Ordinary citizens can't get hold of their money and are limited to taking out just $200 every 2 weeks.
For months now, banks have stopped disbursing dollars and restricted withdrawals in the local currency because of the crisis.
The minute the government defaulted on its debt, all the other debts came in as well, and there was a run on the bank and the whole banking system collapsed.
In the year leading up to that collapse, the economy was already struggling. Frustration at shortages, unemployment, and people not being paid spilled over into national protests and civil unrest.
One of the things that didn't happen in Lebanon was an Arab Spring.
This is what popular uprising looks like. After weeks of scenes like these across the country, resulting in dozens dead. It appears to be the end for Tunisia's president after 23 years in power.
A state of emergency is in place and the entire government has been dismissed.
Either this is the first Arab revolution of the 21st century or it will be brutally suppressed.
We saw 10 years ago this big surge of civil unrest across the Arab world as all these dictatorships, which were also corrupt and badly run and debt-ridden and starting to fail economically, suddenly faced the wrath of their people, and you had these protest movements. Now, Lebanon kind of escaped that because 10 years ago, Lebanon was pretty prosperous. And also Lebanon is, theoretically, is a democracy. But by 2019, it was pretty clear that this economic crisis was coming, that, you know, the debts were building up, people were losing their jobs, you know, that sense of that things aren't as good and people don't know where their next mortgage payment's coming from was starting to spread across society. And the debts it was building up as a government, they were running to try and keep the economy running at this very sort of prosperous level, even though it wasn't productive enough to justify it. The government itself was, you know, starting to say, well, we have to reform. And these two demands by the people who were feeling poor and the government, which was saying we have to reform, which of course often means austerity in some way, clashed. And the trigger was when the then Prime Minister, Saad Hariri, who's the son of this, you know, wartime Prime Minister, or post-war Prime Minister Rafiq Hariri, finally decided to act. One of the things he decided to do was to impose a tax on WhatsApp, whereby you paid a very small sum every time you sent a WhatsApp message. Now, the advantage of the government of doing that...
Make a lot of money in taxes.
We made a lot of money in taxes, but for ordinary people, it was this, like this final straw of this economy that they could see was collapsing. The one thing that everyone had that was free, which was WhatsApp, was suddenly starting to have to pay for, was the kind of the final straw of this dissatisfaction with this corruption and the fact that everyone could see that although the country as a whole was prosperous, most of the prosperity was centred on this sort of elite class close to the political and sectarian leaders. So there was this, you know, let's do this Arab Spring thing 10 years later sort of mood. And exactly the same sort of people that you saw coming out in the early days of the Arab Spring, you know, sort of young, often ideologically driven, liberal classes came and occupied the central squares in Beirut and launched this kind of revolution.
So the economy is in complete crisis. And then suddenly, you know, you've got COVID-19 sort of rearing its head too. What impact did that have on the economy?
It's a good question about all these different factors, you know, what contributed most. There was a joke that no one took COVID very seriously here because even at its worst, it was only the fourth biggest thing anyone had to worry about, you know, after sectarianism, financial crisis and the port explosion, you know, who cared about, you know, a virus?
I mean, that sort of puts it into perspective for the rest of us, I think. And what about the blast? I mean, did that affect the economy
For a lot of people, it was a disaster. You know, people had their homes destroyed and, you know, if they didn't have insurance and they didn't have money, they were stuffed.
It was the final nail. The blast killed 217 people and it accelerated the country's existing economic crisis. For many people, that meant it was now impossible to rebuild their homes and businesses. A year on, Lebanon looks like a failed state. So what hope is there for the future? The government resigned after the Beirut blast, and after a year of political wrangling, a new one was finally installed in September. But will it change Lebanon's luck?
A lot of people are very cynical and say nothing will change. It's the same bunch of crooks in power has dominated Lebanon since the civil war and 30 years ago. And that's, you know, undeniably true. You know, there's no great change to the political makeup of the government, of the ruling classes, if you like, here. The new prime minister was prime minister 10 years ago, briefly. He's also happens to be, by coincidence, of course, Lebanon's richest man. He's a billionaire who made huge amounts of money out of dealings with the Assad regime in Syria. But he's, you know...
How does that go down when the rest of the country is really suffering?
It's controversial, to put it that way. I suppose what you could say is there is a government which is better than nothing. Maybe there's the possibility that things will stabilise a little bit. And there's a multi-billion dollar question, whether there could be any sort of international loan to recapitalise the banking system. Without a functioning banking system, without people able to put money in banks with the assurance they can get it out again, which really is as simple as that here. You can't, you know, really get an economy back on its feet.
But one of the most urgent problems for Lebanon now will be persuading the rest of the world they can invest in the country. Not only will their record of economic mismanagement count against them, but there are serious political problems too. Lebanon has always been split between different factions, with the government being made up of Christians, Shia and Sunni Muslims, in a delicate and often difficult balance. But the current crisis has given one of those factions, Hezbollah, which is both a political party and an Iranian-backed Shia militia, even more power.
You have this astonishing militia, Hezbollah, which has... Its leader says it has 100,000 trained fighters, has 100,000 missiles aimed at Israel. It's, you know, bigger and more powerful than the Lebanese army itself.
Hezbollah supporters cheer and chant as their leader Hassan Nasrallah takes matters into his own hands.
Since the protests of October 2 years ago, those first protests, and since the economic collapse, the role of Hezbollah has been quite interesting because on the one hand, you know, as has always said, it represents the poor. The Shia traditionally were the poorest of the three main sects in Lebanon. On a national level, it stood for the resistance against Israel. And you'd have thought, therefore, that it would be part of the resistance to this elite that dominated political life here for 30 years. But curious enough, when the protests happened, Hezbollah pretty quickly moved in to support the authorities. And, you know, there were some pretty nasty incidents when Hezbollah supporters went in and waded into the protesters and attacked them. The power that Hezbollah has over the politics of Lebanon has become very clear.
Hezbollah, with its Iranian links, is considered a terrorist organisation by a number of Western countries, including the UK and America. It's been a small but inordinately powerful member of successive coalition governments in Lebanon, which is one of the reasons why the Saudis and Gulf states, sworn enemies of Iran, are refusing to invest in the country. Here's what the Saudi foreign minister told CNBC.
We have come to the conclusion that dealing with Lebanon and its current government, with Hezbollah's continuing dominance of the political scene, and we have decided that I think engagement at this point is not productive or useful.
But the Saudis' great enemy, Iran, is now benefiting from the vacuum.
So with the financial crisis and the fuel crisis, Iran has managed to sort of, you know, generate a lot of PR for itself put by saying, well, we can help you. If these Western institutions don't want to lend you money, if they're going to start sanctioning, you know, bankers aligned with Hezbollah and Hezbollah businesses, you know, if they're going to get you like that, then we'll provide you with fuel, cheap rates for your power stations will import diesel to run your hospital generators. And so you've seen Iran muscling in on Lebanese politics and say, well, if the traditional Western business partners of Lebanon are going to let it, you know, collapse, then we'll step in. And obviously, if you're a Hezbollah supporter, that makes perfect sense. Of course, for everyone else, it's kind of threatening because, you know, Iran brings with it the threat of Western sanctions.
So if Iran's influence in Lebanon grows, it could trigger sanctions and make it even harder for the West to help. Although the West, and in particular America, seems to be turning its attention away from the region.
Obama, Trump and now Biden have in common is that they don't want to get involved in these local sectarian squabbles as they see them in the Middle East. Now, how long that could survive, at the end of the day, America is Israel's closest ally. Iran is dedicated to the destruction of Israel. You know, America can't really pull out of the Middle East altogether. But certainly at the moment, the feeling has been, you know, Lebanon is a big crisis, but in a small country, and one that's really not worth America getting too heavily engaged in. So the fallback, I think, that people thought they had, which is, you know, oh, America will step in one way or another, just isn't there. And that's readjusting attitudes all the way across the Middle East, including in Lebanon.
And in the meantime, Richard, for the people of Lebanon, is there any hope? I mean, for you, will you stay on there?
Well, I'm a journalist, so of course, you know, unfortunately, I'm attracted to places where there's trouble. Sometimes think I'd like to write about places that were a bit more positive, but then the world isn't a very positive place at the moment, so may as well stay here. But I'm obviously not typical for people living in Lebanon. For Lebanese, it's hopeless. There's an election happening in March next year, but it's at the moment, you can't find much of a positive attitude for the country.
You've been listening to Stories of Our Times, a podcast brought to you thanks to the subscribers of The Times and The Sunday Times, with me, Manveen Rana, and my guest, Richard Spencer, Middle East correspondent for The Times. You can read more of Richard's work at thetimes.co.uk with a subscription or in print. A special thank you to the BAME Collection for their soundtrack from the 1961 film This Is Lebanon. The producer today was Sevda Moyasari. The executive producer is Kate Ford. And sound design was by Falcon Kisseltuk. If you'd like to get in touch with any ideas for future episodes or any thoughts on what you've just heard, then do drop us a line to storiesofourtimes@thetimes.co.uk. Thanks for listening. See you tomorrow.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Looking for inspiring stories? Listen to the EY Leading Into Tomorrow podcast. It features compelling stories from leaders across government and the public sector who've transformed their organizations and services. From the impact of grants to how digital innovation is reshaping affordable childcare, you'll get actionable insights and ideas that can be used around the world. Download Leading Into Tomorrow by EY wherever you get your podcasts.